You're listening to LNL on ABC Radio National, on Radio Australia, via the World Wide Web and downloadable onto your pod. And my next guest has spent a considerable time with kids in Bosnia after the war and since has been all over the place setting up mental health programs in post-disaster and post-conflict areas like Aceh, Iraq, Pakistan, Mississippi, Sierra Leone. Lynn Jones is, as I said earlier, a child psychiatrist and technical advisor on mental health for an NGO called International Medical Corps, and she's written a book about her time in Bosnia, which investigates the psychological and social well-being of children on both sides of the war, and it challenges some accepted wisdom on the psychological scars of war on children, and perhaps by extrapolation on their parents as well. The book is called And Then They Started Shooting, Growing Up in Wartime Bosnia, and Lynn's on the blower from Cambridge in the UK to talk about it. Lynn, welcome to our little wireless program. I've been anxious to talk about you because it's seemed to me for some years that helping people make sense of it all, you know, in as a consequence of natural disaster, terrorist attack or war, isn't necessarily all that advantageous. And you seem to be finding this in the study of your kids. Let's try and understand what you found in Bosnia, because we need to get a sense of what the received thinking of psychological trauma of war is. Most people would have expected that post-traumatic stress disorder would be a huge issue, but that's not what you found.
No, it wasn't. And I found that actually to be the case repeatedly in other post-conflict and disaster areas as well. First of all, there are people who get PTSD, and I don't think there are many people who deny that. But it's not the overwhelming majority that you often sort of hear in the media, you know, 99% of people will bear the psychological scars for the rest of their life, you know, the kind of thing. Mm. In fact, the majority of people, children and adults, in all these situations, do have enormous skills and abilities to get through these things by themselves and do well. Of course they get symptoms immediately after these events, and the symptoms are what you would expect, you know, disorganization, stress, grief, loss, misery, but these are not psychiatric illnesses which endure forever. And I'm more and more astounded at the ability of people to pull their lives back together. And what was lovely about working with these children for a year and talking with them was learning how they coped and how well they were doing after 5 years of an incredibly brutal war. That was extraordinary to me, and I learned many things about how to get well, in fact, from these kids.
So, Lynn, you find that kids are, yes, angry, they're grieving, they're perplexed, but not necessarily psychologically stunted or permanently harmed.
Indeed, I think that's the case. And what matters is, in fact, what's happening to the people around you and what they're doing and how well they're coping. I mean, actually, Anna Freud, I'm not really saying anything terribly new here, because Anna Freud was saying the same thing in the Second World War. What she found looking at children in the Blitz was the most important thing is, what's your mother and father doing? Are you with them? Do you have people that care and are coping well?
But you make the point that if the kids are with parents and the parents aren't coping, the child won't cope either.
It does seem to be that the mother particularly, but the person close to you, the mental health of that person is very significant. It doesn't mean, I mean, I've got one girl in the book, Svetlana, whose mother was obviously a highly anxious and worried person, and it didn't stop. The girl, in fact, became the copa in the family, the person who really had a lot of emotional strength. But it's interesting that she's one of the people after the war who is more troubled and has more anxiety and more concerns.
Mm.
The problem is, it's complicated. There isn't a simple answer to these things, and context really matters. I found that children in one town had very different coping methods from children in another, but their
We'll get into that, because that's a very intriguing part of the book. But you get going back to Anna Freud. Yes, it's true that she did those studies, but they've almost been forgotten. And the perceived wisdom now is that it's just an appalling situation from which there is very little hope.
I don't agree, actually. I think it's funny how we keep reinventing the wheel. I do think maybe 10 years ago, the kind of attitude to post-disaster situations was like that. But I think we are, all of us, learning. And if you look at publications coming out of WHO and UNICEF today, I'm much more in line now with contemporary thinking than I was 10 years ago. And I do think people know that how you work with whole communities to foster resilience has become more important than how you focus on pathology. And
well,
there has been
I'm quite sure that the people who work in the field know this well, but I don't think journalists do.
No, maybe the media will take a little bit of time to catch up.
Yeah.
here you are talking to me now.
Well, I'm desperate to learn. How do you define psychological trauma?
Oh, I try to avoid using the word trauma because it's so problematic. Are you talking about the insult to the person? Are you talking about a physical injury or a psychological one? Are you talking about the event? Are you talking about the reaction? The word trauma is used for every single one of those things, so it's a confusing word. And
let's dump the word, but I know that you come out of this with the proposition, the observation, that children are not the passive recipients of experiences.
Absolutely. Children look at what's happening around them, and they do try to make sense. My book doesn't say that making sense is not important. It's how you do it and what bits matter to you, and that will depend on where you are and what's happening to you. So I found that children who had had really terrible war experiences in Garajda, where they'd been under siege for maybe 3, 4, 5 years, had seen horrible things happen in front of them. Those children obviously were affected by those events, and they wanted some explanations. And I found that they had more symptoms, the children who'd seen more, which is in line with conventional understanding. The more you'd seen, the more you'd experienced. You were more likely to have more dreams, more nightmares, more fears. And they did want explanations. And in a sense, the making sense process followed from having been exposed to these events. Mm. But something completely different was going on in the other city, where less terrible sort of physical events and less deaths had occurred. Foča was on the Serbian side. It wasn't under siege. It had 3 days of NATO bombing. But otherwise, it got through the war pretty much okay, except parents were on the front line. But what did happen in the town was that the majority of Muslim population were ethnically cleansed in the first few weeks of the war. Now, children didn't see that happen. Most of them were out of the town when it happened. But they came back to a city where all their friends, who were 9 years old at the time, had gone, where half the houses had been burned down, not bombed, where the mosque had been blown up. This is a very curious situation for a 9-year-old child. And come 14, when I interviewed them, and this is the most interesting thing of my study, because no one else seems to have worked with this group of children, if you like, children of people on a perpetrator side. How do they make sense of events? The children that were doing well were avoiding any discussion or any inquiry into these events. And if you think about that, that makes perfect sense. If bad things have happened in your community, it really pays actually to stay away from them, because trying to make sense of things like that if you're 9 to 14 is not a comfortable process.
I wonder if that links to the well-observed phenomenon of Holocaust survivors being absolutely disinclined to discuss their experiences with their children.
Yes, it's very interesting, and I do actually mention one study in the book that shows that actually some of the best the Holocaust survivors who've done best in their lives are not those who are in denial. They're not pretending this didn't happen and, you know, they didn't have bad experiences, but who've gone through their lives without a great sort of reliving, re-experiencing, talking about, searching for meaning. They've just got on and made their lives in the future. There does seem to be some parallel. What I'm raising is the possibility that avoidance has a role in coping, for different reasons. You know, that the common view in psychology is that we must get it all out there, we must ventilate our emotions. This is a very Western individual perspective. And that may be true, and certainly, let's take experiences from Latin America. We have great stories where testimony therapy, you know, finding justice, understanding what happened, has really played a role in survivors of events in those countries. Mm. But it's not the same in all contexts. And sometimes children do better by putting a space between themselves and what happened. Now, for the individual, that's definitely an advantage. The trouble is, as I tried to explain in the book, that can have communal effects on how the past is remembered and what happens in the future. As you can imagine, if you don't want to discuss the past, how do you sometimes heal the wounds of the past? This is another question.
Well, there's been news floating around in the last few days that Ratko Mladic might have been arrested. He was the guy most responsible for the massacre of Bosnian civilians in Srebrenica back in 95. And that leads to the issue of prosecution, which comes up in the book.
Yes.
Now, this program has looked at issues of restorative justice very often over the years, things like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. In the given what you've observed, what you've learned, what are your thoughts on the need for justice, for punishment and reconciliation?
I mean, I have mixed feelings, rather like my children, actually. There was a very clear divide in the communities here. The Muslim children in Garishta, who had had really terrible experiences, there was a paradox. On the one hand, they were much more open to living with their Serbian neighbours again than the Serbian children were living with Muslims. Muslim children found the idea of Serbs coming back, which indeed they were, to live in Garishta, although they'd been under siege for 4 years, they were open to that. But it had to be combined with a discussion of the past and some kind of system of justice. As you can imagine, they were very supportive of the Hague process and Milosevic being on trial, wanted Mladic and Karadzic arrested, wanted the criminals arrested, so in a sense they could be friends with their neighbours again. Mm. That's something that most of us find familiar. Perhaps not surprisingly, the children in Foča wanted to draw a line onto the past. Let's not have any discussion. Let's move on. Let's move on with our own lives. It doesn't help to open these things up. The war crimes trials are biased. Indeed, some children, not all, still regarded Srebrenica as dubious. This was 2002, and things may have changed in the last couple of years. Didn't believe the facts about the rape camps in their own town.
In the high school, indeed.
Indeed, in the school where some of the children were studying. Well, that's very uncomfortable, isn't it? And to be fair, these children were not, in a sense, in denial. This was a big silent issue in the town. Parents, when I raised the subject with them, said, well, we knew nothing about it. We can't believe it happened. And I think there's a long process of coming to terms with these events to take place in Republika Srpska and indeed in Serbia itself. But I think in the last 3 years that process has begun. Republika Srpska itself, the government has acknowledged that Srebrenica has occurred. The Serbian government has played a role. There's been these videotapes on Serbian television. So I would be fascinated to go back. I haven't had a chance in the last 2 years to talk to children again and see how things have moved. I mean, what's been fascinating for me is to see myself how these children have moved from 9 to 14 to 18, you know, and you spend your life making sense of a war like this. And I think you can't set things in stone and say, how will they be forever? I hope things will move towards the direction of wanting to talk, explore, have some kind of exploration and some kind of truth commission, and then move on. And there are people in Sarajevo who've been pushing for that, Serbs, Croats and Muslims all together, because bad things did happen on all sides.
I'm talking to Lynn Jones. Her book is Then They Started Shooting, Growing Up in Wartime Bosnia. And on the front cover there's an unutterably poignant photograph of a child, perhaps 7 or 8, walking down an almost empty and rubble-strewn street away from the camera and into some highly ambiguous future. You began to make a list of the processes people went through to distance themselves from the ethnic cleansing, and you identify 4 elements: minimising, scapegoating, absenteeism and equalising. Can we look at each of those in turn? Minimising.
Well, what I did was I sat down. I mean, it was really interesting talking to people. First of all, I really grew to like these people, the Serbian population in Foča. They're good people, they're decent people. The idea that, you know, one side's bad and the other side's good is completely confounded. But people, and I do believe that, in a sense, this war happened because people were sold a lie. I mean, they were told for 4 or 5 years before the conflict that they were endangered by their citizens, which is how it makes it fellow citizens. How otherwise is it possible to drive your neighbours out unless you believe you're under mortal threat from them? But then looking back on why this happened, one of the ways that people dealt with it was by saying, well, look, you know, what you've been told is a lie, and it really wasn't so bad. In fact, very little of what you've been told actually happened. You know, maybe 10 women were raped, you know, and they exaggerated their experiences.
Well, that's minimising, and one can see the psychotherapeutic benefits of that. Scapegoating.
Well, blaming somebody else is always, you know, an easier way to handle it. You know, a school teacher who himself, unfortunately, and I simply don't know the truth of this, had been, you know, fingered by Human Rights Watch as a participant, simply sort of says, well, actually, it was some psychotic person from the outside forces who came through. You know, there were some psychopaths in the troops who did these things. There were people from another group. This was not us. You know, we didn't do this.
Absenteeism, I guess, is totally self-explanatory, yes.
Well, Kostic used that defence in the genocide trial over Srebrenica. He simply said repeatedly, I was not there. You know, you've made a mistake. It wasn't me. It's very interesting if you read, and obviously I spent a lot of time reading transcripts from these trials. If you read these transcripts, how often major figures in these events, not people in my study, have said not, these events did not happen. That is interesting. They're not saying this did not happen. They're saying, I wasn't there. Which is, in a sense, in itself, a rather powerful acknowledgement.
Absolutely. Equalising. They were just as bad as we were.
It continues to this day. One way of saying, look, it's disgusting. What you're talking about is absolutely disgusting, and I'm appalled by it. But they were just as bad on the other side. And if we didn't, you know, parents, if we hadn't done it to them in advance, they would have done it to us, and they did it elsewhere. Now, I think as history, you know, comes out and continues to come out, it becomes clearer and clearer that this was not a symmetrical war. No, you know, it was 70% of the country was taken, rapidly occupied by one side in the first 3 weeks of the war. And in that 70% occupied territory, terrible things happened. Now, there's absolutely no doubt that the Muslim forces, Bosnian forces, and indeed Croatian forces all committed atrocities as well. But they were not the initial events of the war, and they didn't happen to the same extent, nor did they happen with the same organized dynamic. And I think that's a big difference that has to be come to terms with. There was a systematic attempt to wipe out, or at least completely drive out, one ethnic group. And we have to come to terms with that ourselves, that we allowed that to happen in the middle of Europe in the late 20th century. We have some things to do ourselves, which is what Kofi Annan said in the report on Srebrenica. It's a kind of moral scandal that is still happening today in Darfur, has happened in Rwanda, and we don't seem to be able to get to grips with these mechanisms or confront them. And I'm rather depressed, in fact, that we don't seem to be able to learn the lesson.
Well, so are we. We deal with these issues very frequently on the program. I want to take a big detour just for a minute.
Yes,
from
please.
Bosnia to Bali, and not the recent problems of terror. I visited Bali many years ago when there'd been a sizable earthquake which had wiped out a great number of villages. And I went around with a wonderful Catholic priest, Hannibal Prandi, who was in fact hiding from a political sort of refugee from South America. And he said, look at these people. They spend their lives in prayer, in ritual, to placate, you know, the volcano, to placate the gods. It's 100% effort. This hits them, and they simply can't handle it because of their devotion to the gods, plural, and it hasn't worked. I want to come back to Bosnia and ask you, does religion help these people or not?
I don't think I can make a general answer. I think religion helps different people. For one thing, this was, at least at the outset of the war, a much more secular population than the one you're talking about. I mean, there'd been 40 years of communism. The parents that I talked to said, across both cities, we ourselves were not particularly religious, even if they were not party members. You know, religion had not played a big role. Culturally, it had played a role in defining identity. Serbian Orthodox identity is different from Bosnian Muslim identity. But what was interesting was that as the war continued, religious identity became more important because people were targeted because of it.
You
know, one family said, you know, I've become a Muslim because people are trying to kill me because this is what I am. And that did not lead in Bosnia to a rise of radical Islam, contrary to some press. It did lead to a sort of cultural re-identification. And yes, a few years later, there were a few young men with beards running around the town. But I have to tell you, in modern-day Bosnia, that kind of Islam doesn't go down very well. As some of the girls in the book made clear, you know, if anybody tries to put a veil on me, I'm moving to Republika Srpska. That's never going to happen here. They're very modern young men. They're clearly in the West. And they treat their religion with a sort of healthy, what I feel is a very healthy attitude. And I think It's not for them been a prop. It's not been the main way that they've coped with the bad things that have happened. Big contrast to Aceh, for example, post-tsunami, where I think religion played an enormous role in helping people cope and make sense. Maybe not ways I would have chosen, but the stoicism that faith gave them in the face of disaster has really helped them rebuild. I have not spent so much time... And I don't have such a deep understanding of the Orthodox faith, but I could see that, again, post-war, attendance at church had gone up massively, that people saw it as helping them to define identity. I'm afraid that I also think that on both sides, that religious leaders have sometimes played a role in stoking up animosities. So that's not been helpful and has led to conflict. You've had imams and you've had Orthodox priests saying very unhelpful, derogatory remarks about the other population. But what I also find interesting in Bosnia is, again, a very healthy attitude from the people themselves saying, oh, well, he's a radical, take no notice of him, and we don't listen to him, which I really liked. You know, people were able to reject some of the unpleasant extremes of their own faith and yet still get hope and support from the faith itself.
Now, I know that you're not a big believer in individual therapy, and the book concludes that the best way to help people cope may be to encourage active forgetting. I love that as a phrase. Activities, school, getting on with it. And I recognise that there is no Richter scale for human suffering as there is for earthquakes. But you've just returned from the earthquake-affected areas of Pakistan. How does the experience of people there, the depth of suffering, of unhappiness, contrast to those in Bosnia?
Well, first of all, I want to correct you. I would hate it to be on record that I'm not a believer in individual therapy. I certainly am for those that need it. What I'm saying is that whole war-affected communities are not all psychologically too disturbed to the extent that everybody in them requires individual therapy. If somebody is seriously unwell, and there are people, it's usually not more than 10% who are, I think those people can benefit from many kinds
of
therapy.
Yes, of course. Forgive me. That was a little bit inept. But the overview is that is the idea of active forgetting for Anne.
In some context, yes. Sorry, can you repeat the end question?
I just want you to compare, well, say Pakistan, New Orleans, the various places you've been recently.
Yes.
And to try and evaluate the depth of reaction.
First of all, suffering fills the space it's given, and it's never possible to say, oh well, here you are exposed to Hurricane Katrina, but you live in a first world country and you're much better off than some poor child in Aceh. It's just not true. First of all, actually, if you stand on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi and you look around you, it looks remarkably similar to Aceh. Secondly, you might be living in a first world country, but if you're dumped in a trailer park 25 miles from the nearest shop, nearest church, nearest school, with no transport, as I believe 50% of the population of Mississippi don't have cars, I don't know what the statistics are, but much higher than you'd expect, you're really badly off, arguably worse off than someone in a tent in a village which is only 10 metres from the nearest market in Aceh, because those people can access their supportive communities, which from the psychological point of view, the most important thing is having a supportive, active, functioning social network so that normal morning, normal activities, school, all these things can take place. If you're in the middle of a trailer park in the middle of nowhere with people you've never met before, those things don't happen, so that while your basic needs might be met in a better way, your psychological needs are arguably worse. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely, absolutely. And as you say, it seems palpably obvious, but it hasn't been sufficiently obvious to people organising these things.
No, IMC is running a small psychosocial program in Mississippi, attending to just these kind of needs in a trailer park right there. So I got very involved, and it was a real learning experience for me. And I had been like the rest of my organization. We're an international NGO. We work in about 21 countries. We've never worked in the United States before, but we had private donors who said, you know, please pay attention to this. So we had some money and we went, and I'm very glad we did, because I felt the needs were just as great. And I think the program, although very small, has played a little role in actually addressing them.
Lynn, that's been wonderful. We're out of time, but I thank you very much. Lynn works for the International Medical Corps as a technical advisor in the area of mental health, and her book is called And Then They Started Shooting, Growing Up in Wartime Bosnia, and it's published by Harvard University Press. Lynn, does the International Medical Corps have a website?
Yes, it does. Just go International Medical Corps, and there's a UK and a US website, and both have lots of information about all the things that we're doing. I hope you'll look.
Lynn, thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.